My name is Peter, and I'm an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date of August 16th, 1982, and for that I am grateful. I don't tell you that to impress you. I don't want to change it again. You know, a couple of years ago, I was supposed to come up, and I ran into some cancer, but this is not Cancer Anonymous. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, but I had head and neck cancer, and they never thought I'd speak again, and of course, they didn't know they were dealing with an alcoholic who you can't shut up, you know, and I just wanted to live long enough to see if Zahn bought Harlan big boy pants yet, and those legs have shocked more alcoholics into sobriety than Betty Grable's. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, let me give you a special welcome. And, you know, I think in a room this size, you only maybe get to reach one person. And I hope you pay attention because it was a 9-hour drive. It's only 6 hours, but when you argue with the GPS, it takes a little longer. And I was one of those unfortunate few who came to one too many Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and caught alcoholism. I'll tell you about, I was a periodic drunk in the beginning. I had my first drink at 7, and I didn't drink again till 14. So I was able to handle it between those years. But at 14, one of my friends got to invite 4 other guys to his sister's wedding. She was one of those older women, 18 or 19. And the guys know how you're thinking when you're 14. We're going to score. And we went to this wedding, and we sat at a table, my friend and I, and it was in New York, out on Long Island, and they poured a thing called a Manhattan. God, it was a sexy-looking drink. I mean, I remember the light shining down on it and a cherry floating in it, and, you know, it had this beautiful color, and I drank it, and I felt my toenails get warm. And then I heard tinkle, tinkle, tinkle as my zits fell onto the dinner plate. I had no idea why I'd ever wasted money on Clearasil. But after that drink, I looked over at the table next to us, and they had poured 10 Manhattans, and nobody had showed up. God, you people sound like alcoholics. So my friend Jerry looked at me, and I looked at him, and we changed tables. Now, I have to tell you, we did not eat the 10 salads, but we drank the 10 Manhattans. And as far as I can remember, that was the best damn wedding I'd ever been to. They said I was dancing, and I didn't know how to dance. They said I was singing with the band, and I didn't know how to sing. And I remember I asked one of those older women, one of the bridesmaids, to dance. And she had that cleavage stuff. And I remember dancing with her, and I looked right down her dress. She said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm looking." See, at 14, you're kind of a peeker, you know? You guys sitting next to your wife are going, "No, I never peek." But that night, I remember I was in the bathroom, and my mother was banging on the door, and she's saying, "Are you all right?" And I was reviewing dinner. Peas were coming out of this. No, what do you call it? She said, "What's the matter with you?" And I said, "The chicken was pink." She said, "I told you, never eat pink chicken." To this day, I still check the chicken before I eat it. And that was my first encounter with alcohol. And God, I loved it. I loved it. Something happened in the brain that day. you know, that became the solution to my problems. And now I'm going to skip, you know, to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. You know, if you're new, we've discovered it works best if you don't drink. I don't know why everybody laughs at that. A lot of people don't get that part. As a matter of fact, before I came over, I was on with a lady, a significant other of a guy who keeps forgetting it works best if you don't drink. And I love this meeting because there's no empty seats. See, if I go to an AA meeting and see an empty seat, that represents somebody who thought they could drink again. Because the meetings I go to, we always have a newcomer there. And by now, we should have an upper deck. But alcoholism takes a lot of people from us. But the good news is everybody in this room is going to stop drinking. Everybody in this room is going to stop drugging. Now, I didn't like drugs. I was drunk in a bar in Long Beach. It was in 69 or 70. And cocaine was just coming around at that time. And they put a line of cocaine out, and they gave me a dollar bill. It was a cheap bar. They knew if they gave me 100, I'd have been out the door drinking with it. And I remember I did a line, and I was dead sober. I had just spent $20 getting drunk, and now I'm dead sober. No wonder they call that crap dope. So I was never attracted to that stuff. And when I get downtown, I like to get downtown. My wife, who isn't here with me tonight, I've learned to say, honey, I'm going to speak out of town. And she says, do you want me to go? You know, because she's a writer. And when I'm out of town speaking, it gives her 3 days to write without me saying, what are you doing? You know? But one time I said it, and I said, honey, I got to go out of town and speak. Do you want to come? And she said, I don't think so. And I said, okay. And she said, where are you speaking? And I said, Honolulu. You know, I haven't heard you in a long time. It would be good. Anyway, the reason I know that everybody in this room is going to stop drinking and drugging sooner or later is because I watched my brother Bill quit at 52, and my cousins Joey and Johnny were 42 and 44 when they quit, and my cousin Leo quit a few years ago at 59, and it got down into my second cousins, and my second cousin Bill, he quit drinking. They're all dead, but they don't drink anymore. So that's the promise. The disease has promises. I just like the way Alcoholics Anonymous stops drinking, you know, one day at a time, and the thing. The world record's still 24 hours. Nobody's going to beat that. If you're new and you go to bed tonight, you'll tie the world record 24 hours. The only reason we go to people with a lot of time is we've made a lot of mistakes and we haven't drank over them. So my drinking was getting bad. You know, one of my old sponsors in Jacksonville, Walt Moore, he's dead now. But he used to describe this disease as like an elevator. Only you're an alcoholic of my type, there's only a down button. And if you continue to drink, the elevator begins to go down. And at every floor, things start to get off. And in the beginning, it's just jobs, you know. And that ego will always tell me, oh, you can get another one, don't worry about it. You didn't like that guy anyway. And anyway, then the elevator picked up a little speed, and, you know, driver's licenses start to get off. And money gets off, you know. And then one day, the things you love the most get off. And if you continue to ride that elevator, it hits bottom. And you either get sober or you die from this disease. And today, you have a choice. There is a solution. You know, if you ever look at the chapters, the names on the chapters. See, if I had written chapter 6 into action, I would have been into thinking about it. I was always thinking in a bar how to be a better husband. I was always thinking about showing guys like Harlan pictures of my two little daughters at 2 o'clock in the morning. Aren't they beautiful? And everything. It never occurred to me that I wasn't home with them. And everything. Anyway, the drinking was getting pretty bad. And my wife was looking in the yellow pages under the A section, where I think they keep the attorney people. And out of nowhere, I said, listen, I'm going to go to that Alcoholics Anonymous thing. My brother went to it, and they taught him to drink like a gentleman. Now, I had an older brother. He was 7 years older than me. And the job of the older brother is to pin you down when you're a kid and dribble spit over your face. And then try to suck it up. My brother was not a good sucker-upper. Someday I will write a book, What Older Brothers Have Done to Younger Brothers. And if you're a younger brother, see me after the talk tonight. Anyway, my brother had been the first one to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. He was in a treatment center, and they suggested he might have a drink. No, it was a psychiatric center. It wasn't a treatment center. They told him he was deeply depressed, he might want to talk to a couple gentlemen from AA, or he could take electric shock treatment. He took electric shock treatment. Well, don't be ridiculous. Did you think you were that bad that you'd have to go to AA? You know? And of course, I was still drinking at the time, and you know, I used to call him the lamp, you know? And I remember I was back in New York, and Bill was still going to AA at that time. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, but we were at my parents' house, and I had both parents in the hospital at the time. Bill came in from a date, and he knelt down and started to say his prayers. And I said, what the hell are you doing? And he said, I'm praying. And I said, well, pull the blinds, for God's sakes. You know, somebody might see you. They think we're doing bad things in here. And, you know, and that was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, was my brother. And my brother said he would never drink in the state of New York. Unfortunately, he went to Puerto Rico on vacation. He not only got drunk, he came back married. So if you're thinking maybe you don't want to give up alcohol, listen to that story. You know, and if you got here late, you missed three of the great speakers. Rhoda, yeah, that was just a beautiful share. And that daughter of yours has just the most beautiful laugh and everything. Until I heard Mary's laugh. I got to tell you, Mary, if you laugh like that during sex, I think I know the problem. All right, that guy's applauding a little too long there. And Linda, that was a beautiful share. And, you know, that was a heartbreaking thing. And I've been to a number of Al-Anon meetings. And they use the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous just like we do. But I have never heard in an Al-Anon meeting the quote from the big book that alcoholics are above average intelligence. I always wanted to know, did the sponsors tear that page out of your big books? Anyway, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, just keep coming back. Give yourself a break. Now, I told my wife I'd go to AA, and right after I said it, I said, that's stupid. Why did you say that? And she said, okay. And I said, they taught Bill to drink like a gentleman, because he had told me, you know, that he was now drinking like a gentleman and he could handle it. Anyway, I called the general telephone operator and I told her, I have a friend who needs Alcoholics Anonymous. Could I have the number? That's where the ego is at that point. And she told me, and I called General Service Office. I lived in San Dimas, California at the time. And they said there was a meeting in Pomona, California. And I went to this meeting. But it was an 8:30 speaker meeting, and I got off work at 5 o'clock. Well, what does an alcoholic do? He goes to a bar, you know. And then about 7:45, I left the bar, and I bought a pint of scotch, because going to your first AA meeting is kind of scary. I didn't know they have raincoats and flasher, or, you know, what it would be like. Anyway, I'm sitting in the parking lot, and I'm drinking this pint of scotch, and I'm waiting for the alcoholics to arrive. And I could have looked in the rearview mirror and seen the first one, and these nice cars started to pull in. And people were getting out, and they had suit jackets on, and so women had skirts and heels at the time, and I thought, God, this church is really nice. A lot of nice people are coming to this church, and I'm waiting for the alcoholics to arrive. And, you know, and I'm thinking, well, maybe the meeting was canceled. I can go home and tell her the meeting. And sure enough, a white van pulled in. We know how alcoholics travel, in white vans. Now, how do I know that? I used to drive by a care unit in Orange County, and there were 8 white vans parked out front. So I'm watching this white van, and 8 of the shiftiest-looking people you've ever seen in your life get out of this van. One lady, she had hair sticking all up. Looked like she hit a 220-volt line. So I watched them, and they go into this church classroom. And I get out of the car, and I wasn't walking too steady, and I weighed about 300 pounds at the time. And I followed them into this classroom, and the lady with the shock hair looked at me. I looked at her, and I said, "Is this Alcoholics Anonymous?" She laughed and said, "No, we're the church choir. We just got back from camping. A is right down the hallway." So the first night, I'm utterly confused. So I got into the back row. You know, the old-timers used to call the back row the shoe department, where the loafers and slippers all hang out. And and I'm in the back row full of acceptance. You know how we are? And I go into a blackout. And I come out of the blackout as they're reading from chapter 3, and I hear, "We have tried natural wines." That's all I remembered. Next thing I know is 2 big guys are holding hands with me. And I'm from New York City. You don't hold hands with guys, you know. And so I go home that night, and she said, "How was that A&A thing?" I said, "It was all right." And she said, "Well, what are you supposed to do?" I said, "I'm supposed to drink natural wine." Anybody out there was a wine drinker, a wino, or a winette? Anybody? Anybody? My hat's off to you. How you're alive after drinking that crap. For a week, I could hear the hair growing out of the follicles on my head. My tongue would try and shower by itself. I went back to scotch. I thought you people were crazy. And I would go to that meeting drunk once a week, full of commitment. You know, going to a meeting drunk is trying to like eating pizza with Slim Fast. You're probably not going to have a lot of good results. But it came to an end one morning in a kitchen in San Dimas when my wife was crying. And, of course, alcoholism is a mental illness. It's a disease of perception. I couldn't perceive why she was crying. I'd given her some of the worst years of her life, for God's sakes. But she was crying like the little girls used to cry, you know, with that. And I said, "Why are you crying?" And she, all of a sudden, the crying stopped, and she went dead cold. And she said, "Because you love the bars and you love alcohol more than you love the girls and I." And I had 2 little girls. And see, because I had that older brother, I only wanted girls, you know. And I wanted a blonde with blue eyes, and I got that. I wanted a brunette with green eyes, and I got that. You know, and I loved those little girls. They were just toddlers. And I said, "Honey, I won't drink today." And she said, "I don't care. Tomorrow I'm taking the girls and I'm leaving. You love the bars and alcohol more than..." And I said, "It's not true. I will not drink today." And by 2 o'clock, I was dead drunk in a bar in Long Beach. I have no power over alcohol whatsoever. The one day I did not want to drink was that day. Because I married a strong lady, and I knew when she said that, if I screwed up, it was over. So what does an alcoholic do? He drinks more to get rid of those feelings and the, what do you call it? And that night, I woke up asleep on top of the bar. Now, I don't know whether you ever slept on a bar at 2 o'clock in the morning, but they really get sticky. I opened my eyes, and my friend Ernie was sitting there, and I couldn't move my face. I said, "Ernie, I'm paralyzed." And he reached over and grabbed my head and kind of peeled me off the bar. And he said, "No, you're just stuck, that's all." Now, to show you the high-class dinner house I was in, where they just let this fat guy climb up and go to sleep on the bar. And the barmaid just passed drinks over my ass all night, you know. You know, this is the sensitive part of my story here. Harlan told me there'd be more sensitive people here tonight. And apparently they're having parking problems. So I sat on the bar stool and I said, "Ernie, we're alcoholics." And he said, "Yeah, they're closing. You want another?" And I said, "Get me a scotch." And what do you call it? But that night, that keen alcoholic mind kicked in. And I came up with a financial plan to take care of those girls and my wife. And I used to drink with insurance guys at Diamond Jim's. And they would laugh about, "No, we proved it was a suicide, so the thing didn't." So I knew I had to make it look like an accident. And God, that keen alcoholic mind went into high gear. And I came up with a plan that I would fall out of the car at 75 miles an hour on the... This is the sensitive... And it would look like an accident that I had just leaned against the car and fallen out on the freeway. Now, I don't know whether you ever tried to open a car door at 75 miles an hour. It is a son of a bitch trying to get a door open. I couldn't get the damn door open. But see, the keen alcoholic mind thinks again. Slow down. Get the door open. So I slowed down to 15 miles an hour in the middle of an L.A. freeway at 2 a.m. And I got the car door open, got my leg out. I looked down and I said, "Shit, this is really going to hurt. You better speed it up, it'll be over faster." So I sped up, and now the door's closed on my leg and I can't get in and I can't get out. Other audiences are normally in tears. So the suicide became a pain in the ass at this point. And I stopped the car, and I drove home. I weigh 300 pounds, and we have a waterbed. And it was one of those old ones before they had the baffles. It was just a big garbage bag is what it was. And I got to sneak in without waking her. Because sometimes I used to come home and just flop on the bed and she'd go about 9 feet in the air. "You're sure they're sober?" When I got up that morning, she and the girls were gone. And I don't know what you still have left if you're new. But I know that the disease of alcoholism will come for it. Because that's what it wants, is everything you love. And eventually it comes for our lives. Anyway, I went to work that day. It was a Thursday. It was pouring rain, I remember that. And I was in sales, which is not good if you're afraid of people. Because that paranoia comes with the alcoholism. And I unplugged the phone and I just sat there. I knew if I went out to lunch, I'd have a drink and I'd finish the suicide. And I drove home that night and the house was dark. And I couldn't turn the lights on because I was afraid I'd see the girls' toys on their floor. And I had nowhere to go but that stupid Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I've been going drunk for 5 months, so you people hadn't been much help at all. And I went in, but this was the first meeting I'd ever gone to without a drink in me. And I sat in the back row the shoe department, full of acceptance. And they introduced the speaker that night. The guy's name was Jimmy Ryan from Malibu. Some of you old-timers might remember him. But he had a Texas accent. And I still remember he said, "My name is Jimmy Ryan, an alcoholic." I just lost my family. I'm about to be fired by the bank. And I got this shit kicker who's going to talk tonight. And I had a big cup of coffee balanced on my lap with a line of donuts that I had done. And I wasn't paying attention. And all of a sudden he went, "Hot damn, let's get it on." He scared the hell out of me. I spilled hot coffee all over me. Now I'm in the back row dancing with hot coffee all over me. And Ryan's pointing at me like I just caught the Holy Ghost. And that was my first spiritual experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that night, Jimmy Ryan had driven in the rain for 2 hours from Malibu. Now, if you're a Southern California, you know leaving Malibu and driving to Pomona, he didn't have both oars in the water, let's put it that way. Pomona's not the end of the world, but you can see it from there with a good stepladder. But that night, Jimmy Ryan told my story, because he was a salesman. And he talked about selling the tires off the company car to pay the bar bill. And I hadn't done it yet, but I had thought of it. I'm thinking, God, they can read your mind, Jesus. I don't know what you call it. But he told me I'd never have to take another drink again one day at a time. If I was willing to do what the people suggested in the first 164 pages of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would never meet Jimmy Ryan again. Anyway, at 90 days, I was going to meetings downtown. And because I didn't want people in my neighborhood to think I had a drinking problem. You know? It didn't matter that one day I woke up on the front lawn as the sprinklers came on. But being a keen alcoholic mind, I was adjusting them. In a suit. Soaking wet. Anyway, I had 90 days of sobriety, and my boss, Jack, said he was coming down from San Francisco. I was with Crocker Bank at the time. And I'm thinking, wow, this program really works. I'm probably going to get a new car. I haven't had a drink in 90 days. God, those promises. Just like that. Jack called me in the office, and I think he doesn't want the other salesman to hear that I'm going to get a new car. He said, "Peter, you're the biggest screw-up Crocker Bank has ever hired, and we're going to let you go at the end of the year." And I almost said, "Does this mean I don't get a new car?" This is why we tell you, don't make any big decisions your first year, okay? And I went to old Alan downtown, and he said, "How's it going?" And I said, "Alan, they're going to let me go at the end of the year." And he had that old-timer laugh. Hee, 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 hee. If he had had teeth, I would have knocked them out. And he said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I'm going to play golf. They're going to let me go at the end of the year." And he said, "You know, we just don't do that in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You owe that bank 8 hours a day, 5 days in a row. Go give them that." I don't know whether any of you remember that day. It was the longest day in the history of the world. I had never worked 8 full hours before. I still think it's highly overrated, I got to tell you. But I would do that, and I started to work those steps, and I witnessed the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, this power that comes to the room. You know, I had the good nuns, and my eighth grade teacher is still alive. She's 99, I think. And I want to send her a card, but if she saw my name on the return address, I'm afraid it would kill her. They formed 2 7th grades and 2 8th grades because none of the nuns would take us in the same class. So they split my friend and I up, the one who had drank the Manhattans with me. And I remember I think I was about seven, first grade maybe, and the nun showed me a picture of the saint. And the guy's hair was on fire. He had kind of one eye hanging out, and he had arrows sticking out of his ass. And she said, "Peter, do you want to be a saint?" I was smart enough not to say, "Let me get back to you that on that, sister." And I said, "Well, certainly, sister, I want to be a saint." And I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard, "We are not saints," and I thought, "I'm in." None of that Bernie hair stuff or anything. Anyway, what happened to me was, by the end of that first year, that first year of sobriety, I was the number one salesman in the bank because of a power I choose to call God, only because it make the old nuns happy, and I'm still making amends to them, for God's sakes. And I used to go to a meeting, and I didn't realize that was Dr. Paul over there. I thought it looked kind of like Clancy, and I thought, my God, if Clancy find out you put him behind the screen, you're... Give me a dollar, I won't say anything. But Dr. Paul was a friend of mine, and he started the morning meetings all over this country. Whenever he'd be assigned a new place, he'd start a morning meeting, and that was a great meeting. As a matter of fact, Sister B used to go to that meeting, and every time she'd get up to speak, she'd whack me in the back of the head. I said, "B, I mean, the first time, B was an attractive woman, I got to tell you, and the first time she got up to speak, I didn't know who she was, and I thought, wow, that lady's got some figure." And the guy next to me said, "That's Sister B." And I said, "God, I just lusted after a nun." And I told B that, and she said, "Do you think so?" But I said, "B, why do you always hit me?" And she said, "Because of kids like you, we have no nuns left in the Catholic Church. That's why." And I said, "Dear God, I'm 40 years of age, and they're still whacking me, you know." And anyway, what happened is the guy who came down, you know, to let me go at the end of the year, I would hire him back into the bank 3 years later. I had taken his job as the national sales manager. And so I know about the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and these 12 steps and this thing. And I would go on to become fairly successful in the banking thing. Now, I was 3 years sober, and my wife said, "Peter, I'd like a divorce." I said, what page are you on? You know, I'm trying to be the best dad I can to these two little girls and the, what do you call it? But, you know, she knew this drunken ass used to come home, and now this ass just came home, you know? And we would separate for a year, and I loved that woman. And I had a sponsor who would say, "Well, bring her flowers." And she'd take the flowers and throw them in the waste paper basket. And I'd call him, and he'd say, "They're her flowers. She can use any vase she wants." I thought he was a very insensitive man. Anyway, what happened was one of these God shots, I got a call from a headhunter, and I don't know whether you've ever experienced a headhunter. They always call you and go, "Can you talk?" "I think so." And he said, "We'd like you to interview with the Chase Bank in L.A. They're looking for a West Coast regional exec." And I said, "I don't want to work from New York Bank. I'm happy at Crocker. You know, we're a San Francisco bank." And Lucia was living in L.A., and my office was in San Francisco. And I had a wonderful boss who left me have an office in L.A. so I could fly back and forth and see the girls whenever I wanted. And they were awfully good to me. And the headhunter said, "Peter, you always interview well. Just do this for me." And, you know, when you don't want the job, you really give a great interview, I gotta tell you. "Well, I do this, and then I do this, and then I do this, and bam, 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 what do you call it?" And I went back to San Francisco, and I didn't want my boss, Bob, to know, you know, that I had the interview. And I said, "Bob, I had an interview with the Chase. I didn't want, you know, to find out on the street that I was looking for anything, but I wanted to talk to them to see what they were doing. And these are their plans for California, and they're going to be pretty formidable group, and he said, well, he said, you know, I want to go into the bank, and you will be considered, you know, for the presidency of the leasing company. And so I walked back to my office, and I'm dun, 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 dun. Every time I went by my boss's office, I'll change those drapes, you know, and about 3 months later, Bob calls a meeting off campus, and he said, this is a top secret meeting. The bank's out of tax shelter. They're going to liquidate the leasing company. And I said, well, what about us princes that we're going to be the president? And he said, it's every man for himself. Run for your life. And and by that time, Lucia had started putting the flowers in a vase. And it, when she did it, when I she wasn't looking, I'd go, yes, okay. Now, what do you call it? And I called my wife. I said, honey, I have some good news and bad news, and I don't know what you'll take. I said, I'm going to have to be coming home. And she said, well, we've been talking about putting it back together again, and I think this is the time. And I said, well, the bad news is I don't have a job. She said, Peter, you'll always have a job. I don't worry about that. And I called the headhunter, and I said, Mike, this is top confidential. I don't want to hear it out on the street, but the bank's going to liquidate us, and I'm looking for a job. And he said, well, you know, the guy you interviewed with, he keeps comparing everybody to you and the, what do you call it, and he hasn't found anybody yet. And I had a beard at that time, and he called the Chase in New York, and I shouldn't mention their name. After me talking, they'll have to be a run on the bank, for God's sakes. But he called them, and Ted said, how married is he to that beard? And I went, what beard? You know, now I need a job. And so I flew to New York. I flew home on Friday. And anyway, what happened was on Sunday, I was on an airplane, and I flew into New York. And I knew I needed to go to an AA meeting because they had to put me up in the Penn Statler Hotel. And there was a big toy convention. And I walk in, and here's a guy in a chicken suit with a bottle of vodka running around. And and I thought, I probably should go to an AA meeting. And I went to an AA meeting, and this guy said, where are you going? I said, I'm going back to the hotel. I told him a little what was going on. And they said, you know, there's a 10 o'clock meeting up on the west side. Come on, jump in the car. I'll take you up to it. We'll go to it. You won't sleep. You know, you'll be tossing and turning. You need another AA meeting. And I walked into that meeting, and there was a little lady there behind the couch who I used to pick up from a psychiatric facility and take to AA meetings, and what do you call it. And 3,000 miles away, she screams, Peter, what are you doing in New York City? And she ran across the room and threw her arms around me, and I knew at that moment it was going to be okay. That's all I need is a sign like that. And anyway, what would happen would be during the interview the next morning, I realized they were trying to sell me on coming with the bank. And but now I had told them all of these great things I was going to do, and now I had to do them, and I'm like, and what do you call it? And I would be with the Chase for 5 years, and every morning that I was at the bank, Monday through Friday, I would go in, and there wasn't a lock on the door. We weren't allowed to have locks on the office. You could tell I was important because I had two pens in my pen set, and the other guys only had one, you know. And I would kneel down, and I'd open the bottom drawer, and I had the book Alcoholics Anonymous in there. And I would read a page, and I would say, God, I haven't the faintest idea what the hell they're talking about half the time, but I believe you know how to do this, and I need your help today. And that region went from 5 million to 100 million in 5 years. And the poor guy who took it up, who replaced me, took it from 100 million to 28 million the following year. I knew I should have left the book, even though he wasn't an alcoholic. And, because of all the business books I've ever had with an MBA, this is the only one that's ever worked for me. And and what happened was my girls were growing up, and Lucia said to me, you're living on airplanes, Peter, and the girls miss you. And what do you call it? why don't you think about making a career change? I'm thinking, you know, we're making a lot of money. I have a lot of perks and everything, and what am I going to do? And what do you call it? So I thought I might be a minister. It's tax-free. So I remember I drove up to Fuller Seminary in Los Angeles. They were having a thing for ministry students, prospective students. And there were two ladies walking across the thing. And I said, excuse me, could you tell me where Fuller Ministry is? And the lady said, we can't tell you. We're Catholic nuns, and they're on the other side. And they started giggling because they were going there, and what do you call it? And I went there, and I listened to the guy talk about, you know, we're given special gifts, you know, and that tells us where we're to go in life. And I kind of knew this wasn't the answer. So I talked to a friend of mine, Pat O'Reilly. He's dead now. He was a number of years sober in AA. And Pat said, do you ever think of becoming a clinical social worker? I said, Pat, I'm a capitalist. And he said, well, why don't you talk to the psychologist then? And I talked to the psychologist, and they said, God, with your contacts, we can make a lot of money. And I was already making a lot of money. And I talked to the social workers, and they all said, how can we help you? How can we help you? And it sounded a lot like what I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew this was the road. So I talked to my sponsor, Deke, at the time. Deke Kennan was my sponsor. He was a man who would die 42 years sober in La Verne, California. And he died in a hospital, and before he went into a coma, he had them dial his wife, who was homesick. And he said to her, I fell in love with a little girl of 17 years, and I love her more today than I've ever loved her, and I want you to know that. And he went into a coma after they hung up the phone. And to leave a marriage like that, you know, is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw Deacon Joy lose one of their sons, and Bucky was the only one of the sons out of five sons, you know, who was an alcoholic, and he was killed in a car accident. And what do you call it? And we were at the Bucky's memorial, and Deke and Joy asked the minister to read a letter. And I turned to the guy next to me, and he had about 30 years at that. Deke had about 30 years, and I said, now you're going to hear 30 years of sobriety. And in that letter, they thanked God for letting them have Bucky for all of those years to watch their son grow into manhood. And he was a member of Al-Anon, and the other four boys were in AA. And everything. And I remember one time, I don't know whether you've ever had a teenager, but nothing helps with steps 6 and 7 like a teenager. Now, my oldest daughter is developmentally delayed. She has Prader-Willi syndrome. And she developmentally, she's about 8. And I said to Deke one time, I said, you know, Jenny is developmentally delayed. And he looked at me and he said, you mean the one who always hugs me and tells me that she loves me? And I said, that's the one. He said, we were in our 30s and 40s before we figured out that's what it's all about. Who the hell do you think is developmentally delayed? But when my youngest, Kirsten, came out of the chute at 13, we had a big golden retriever. And she took the dog clippers and buzzed her entire head. And this is before Sinead O'Connor even thought of it. And then she bought a black leather jacket, a pair of my father's underwear hanging out of the back, peg pants, and army boots. And we were the anonymous parents. We had bags over our head with the eyes cut out. One time I get a call from the San Diego Sheriff's Department. Are you the father of Kirsten Smith? She's about 15. I said, God, let her be alive so I can kill her. I said, yes, I am. And they said, well, we have a bunch of the girls down there. They were up in the park. They were with older guys, and there was beer there. And, you know, we picked up all of the girls and took them down to the station house. You'll have to come get them. So I called Deke and I said, Deke, I'm phoning in the homicide before I do it. And he laughed, and I didn't think it was that funny. And he said, what's the matter? And I said, Kirsten's down at the San Dimas Sheriff Station. And he said, you know all five of my boys, don't you? They're all grown men at this time. And I said, yeah. I said, I picked up every damn one of them from the San Dimas Sheriff Station. He said, she's scared to death right now, Peter. Go down, give her a hug, tell her you love her, but you're never going to pick her up again from the San Dimas Sheriff Station. So if she plans on going again, she has to make other travel arrangements. You know what? I never had to pick her up again from the San Dimas Sheriff Station. But about a year later, I think she was about 16, Lucia and I were going river rafting. And so we farmed the girls out to neighbors, and we got home, and we walked in the house, and Lucia said, God love her, she came up and cleaned the entire house. She had a party. She says, you are so cynical. I said, let me see how good she was. My God, I walked around. The carpet looked brand new. I go out in the garage and brand new shiny bags and all the garbage cans. I said, damn, she's good. I go out to the pool, and only an alcoholic could see a Budweiser cap 8 feet underwater. Gotcha. So you know when they're 15 or 16, they come back and they walk in, go hi, and go right to their room. No shit. Mom, Dad, how was the river? Was it fun? Was it exciting? And what do you call it? And I let her go on for 5 minutes and I said, how was the party? Nobody got arrested, Dad. I said, nobody got arrested. So she was grounded for 4 weeks. And she's eating cereal one morning. She's off the grounding. And I said, Kirsten, how big was the party? She never looked up, kept eating her cereal. She said, is that double jeopardy involved? And I said, double jeopardy? And she said, yeah, you can't be tried twice for the same crime. I said, double jeopardy is in effect. And she looked up with a big smile and she said, the sheriff's department said there were 300 people here. Now, we had a 4-bedroom ranch house. And I said, how the hell did nothing get broken? She said, we stripped the entire house and locked it in the bedrooms with the dogs. And what do you call it? And then we had a kid with a rented shampooer. Anybody spilled anything, he went over and spilled it, and then he did all of the rugs. And she said, and I said, then all of a sudden I realized when we had driven in, behind the pool wall was a big row of high bushes. And when we came home, I said, God, we must have had some wind. Look at the bushes are all flat. 300 kids went over the wall. And she said, they didn't arrest anybody, but the helicopter with the searchlight. See, I think if you don't have a teenager, Alateen should rent people out to you. Because I ended up with character defects I don't think God knew I had. You know, and today she runs the sound studio for Universal. She's managing it. Her last raise was $36,000. We hope to have a little house at the end of the estate. And if we shower, she might let us use the pool, you know? So if you got teenagers, trust me, we know what you're going through. But eventually they do grow up, you know? And I love the two of them. And a few years ago, I was speaking in Honolulu at the Hawaiian Convention. And she flew over to surprise me on her own American Express card, which was a real surprise. You know, today she called me about a couple of months ago and she said, Dad, We've got a guy here at the studio, and he's got a real drinking problem. Can I give him your phone number? And I said, certainly, honey, you give anybody you want my phone number. And I talked to the guy for about an hour on the phone, you know, and he just couldn't get down that it works best if you don't drink, you know. And I said, well, just try not drinking today. You know, that's the world record, and he liked that. And what you taught me is that in these 12 steps, they're all about relationships. And in the first three, you told me get a relationship with this thing called God. Now, see, I was Irish up until 7, and then they made me a Roman Catholic. I wasn't sure what the hell it was at 7, but they said I was one. And I grew up with kind of the Old Testament God, you know, the one where he turned the lady into salt for looking back. And here I am, I'm a peeker, you know, and I don't even think I'm going to make salt with this guy. And you know, and Bill Wilson in his writings believed the most important thing to come out of these 12 steps was that one phrase repeated in two steps, God as we understood him. And thank God for these words that Bill chose, because in the second step, Bill said, came to believe. It didn't say we believe. How many of us would be here today if you had to believe, you know? But it said we came to believe. We came to meetings, and we started to see things change in our life. You know, we started to see relationships get a little better and everything. And, you know, when I take a guy through the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, a newcomer, and we get to that third step, where that third step prayer is, there's a sentence after the third step prayer. It says, we thought well before taking this step. I don't know about you, but that sounds like a warning to me. And typical alcoholic, he puts it after you take the step. So I always have the newcomer read that, and I say, are you sure you want to take this step? You know, you tell him, you question whether he wants to do it, and he wants to do it. You're not going to deprive him of this step. And the thing. So we get on our knees, which always makes the newcomer nervous, and we say that third step prayer together. And I have to say that every day, because I have a mind like a sieve. I read this morning the things you tell me to read, and I have the faintest idea what the hell I read. You know, it just doesn't, but you tell me to do things, and I do them, and it seems to work out. And, you know, in 4, 5, 6, and 7, you told me to get a relationship with myself. And I thought I had a good relationship with myself until I was shaving one morning and saw the guy with a razor under my throat who tried to kill me. I still like an electric razor. I thought I had a good relationship with myself, but I was the one who had done it to me all of these years. And in that fourth step, I was abused as a kid. And I couldn't fill in that column, you know, about what part I played in it, because I was a child when it happened. And my sponsor, Deke, pointed out to me that who was continuing the abuse, all of the... You know, I have a bad heart. And then in 8 and 9, you told me to clean up all of my relationships with everybody else, you know? And I remember there was a guy I worked with, and I'd ripped him off on a deal for $500. And my sponsor at the time said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I thought I'd go to Bob and tell him I'm sorry. And he said, well, that'll make Bob just feel peachy keen that you're sorry. He said, if you're going to make financial amends, I suggest you bring a check. $500 was a lot of money. Now, the first year, I was willing to make financial amends because I didn't have any money. The second year, I made a lot of money, and I wasn't so willing. And then he explained to me that it wasn't my money. It was Bob's money that I had. I bet a few newcomers will want to skip that step. But there's reasons we have numbers on them. You know, and if you follow those numbers with a good sponsor, it'll all work out. That's all I can tell you. So I get the check, and I start driving over to see Bob, and I don't know if Bob ended up in AA, so he's probably alcoholic. But then alcoholic gear kicks in, and I'm thinking, if I give Bob this $500, he's going to get drunk tonight. He's liable to hit a bus with handicapped children in it. And I'll be responsible because... And finally, I heard my sponsor's voice, shut up and give him the check. And I gave Bob the check. And a few years later, I'd be speaking at a meeting in Long Beach, and there'd be Bob in the back row with his hand up as a newcomer. You know, and Bob and I are good friends today. He lives down in Palm Springs. And before I forget, I want to thank my friend Brad for driving up with me. They don't like me driving. I just got finished with radiation about a year and a half ago, and I tend to nod off, but Brad speaks a lot, and after about 5 minutes of dozing off, I come right out of it, but we've been good friends for the past couple of years, and, you know, he has seen the magic in Alcoholics Anonymous in his life, and, you know, in 10, 11, and 12, you taught me that I can maintain all three of those relationships on a daily basis. When I'm wrong, I promptly admit it. We have a guy out in our Roosh 9:03 a.m. meeting who believes that it said when he came in, we probably admitted it. And that somehow we changed the word after he had been in for a while. And now my two home groups, which I'm active in, is the Roosh 9:03 a.m. meeting and there's a bad rumor that it's a 9:03 because they spilled so much meth out there that it spins 3 minutes faster than the rest of the county does, so they adjusted the schedule. And but the true story is we had a guy with 6 months years ago, and we knew he was probably going to get drunk again, so we made him the secretary so he'd have that commitment. And he worked for the county. And every Saturday, he'd show up and explain why he was late for 3 minutes. So the group just took a group conscience, and we changed it to 9:03. And it's been 9:03 probably for 15, 16 years now. And if you're ever up in the Roosh area, just drive by the casinos and the hotels. And if you don't see any of those, look for the movie mouse. That's where we are. Because Roosh is a real small little place, and I'm from New York City in Los Angeles, and, you know, I took that third step every day, and I was in the boardroom of the Chase Manhattan Bank. We had a meeting back there, and it's a room that looks like Cecil B. DeMille does banking. You know, it looks out over New York Harbor, and I'm thinking of making this career change, and I'm sitting there, and I looked like the other princes. I had a nice English suit on and a tie and English shoes, and I was starting to speak like an English guy, and a voice said, this part of your life is over. Now, I put people in lockup wards for hearing voices today, and anyway, this friend of mine, Pat Riley, had convinced me, and there were only two schools that I could apply for in clinical social work that I could get to. One was Columbia in New York, and I couldn't take the family back to New York. And the other was USC. And that Christmas, my wife gave me, she'd always give me nutty presents for Christmas. One year, we're in a hot air balloon, you know, and I'm afraid of heights, and I'm a devout coward. It's kept me alive this long. And one year, we're in a racing boat, sailboat off of Santa Barbara Island, and the guy down in the cabin is making sandwiches, and he's on his back because I got the boat tilted, and we're going right at the dock. And I'm going, Doc, 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 the dock's coming up. And this guy, you know, he like goes, okay, the dock. Drop the sail here. And there we go. We're all right and everything, you know. And only my cleaner knows how scared I was. And so this Christmas, she gave me a big box with a guy hanging off a rope, a mountain climber. And I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. She's trying to kill me. I don't know, what do you call it? But inside was a book, How to Pass the Graduate Record Exam. And it was the scariest present I ever got in my life. I opened it up, I read the directions, didn't understand them, closed the book and slipped it under the couch. And it was there until we moved, I believe. And I thought, I can't pass the graduate. I've been out of school too long. And so Deke told me to call USC and ask for a consultation. And I called USC, the School of Social Work, and this woman said, what a coincidence. Monday, we're having a meeting for prospective students. And I thought, yeah, I've heard these coincidences before. And, you know, now I hear the train kind of going down the track, and I hear switches being thrown. And so I go down, I leave the bank Monday morning, and I go down, and I got a three-piece suit on, and I'm walking across the campus, and I'm getting fatter and dumber. You know, by the time I get to this classroom, I'm in third grade. My nephew calls USC the School of Orthodontist Children because they all have perfectly white teeth and look like cheerleaders, you know. And so I'm sitting in this room with about 30 or 40 people, and this woman comes in and she says, I'm here to tell you why USC is considered one of the best clinical schools of social work and everything like that. And she's going on, and I'm like, And she says, she looked right at me, and she says, of course, you know, you don't have to take the graduate record exam. This is the only degree at USC that it's not required for. We found out people who did very well on the GRE made absolutely lousy social workers. Now the engine's picking up steam and the switches are starting to get thrown up ahead. And she says, but you will write an autobiography of your life experiences. And I'm thinking, do I want to tell this lady I used to weigh 300 pounds, drink a quart of scotch a day, and try to fall out of a car to get the insurance money? You know, so they're going down the row, and some guy was captain of his hockey team. My ankles went just like that immediately. And another lady had written a book, and I'm, oh, my God, you know. And she goes, sir, would you like to share? And all I could hear is Deke saying, just be honest. I said, a number of years ago, I used to weigh 300 pounds. I drank a quart of scotch a day, and I tried to kill myself by falling out of a car at 75 miles an hour. And today, I'm regional exec for one of the New York banks, and I'm thinking of making a career change. She said, God, that's absolutely marvelous. I almost said, you want to hear some other shit I did? And she keeps looking at me as they're going around. She keeps looking at me, and I think she's hitting on me. But afterwards, I went up to see her, and I said, I didn't really do real well in college. And she said, what was your grade point average? And I said, well, it was a 2.00001. You needed a 2.0 to get out, and I had that 1. And she said, well, Peter, you'll probably have to take the GRE. And my stomach opened up. And she said, did you do any graduate work? I said, well, I have an MBA. She said, how in God's name did you get into graduate school? I said, well, it was a new graduate school. And they said, what were your marks? And I said, close to a B. What's a letter in between among friends, you know? And I said, by the time my marks showed up, they put me on probation because a couple of professors went to... I was the only guy to get my degree and get taken off probation on the same day. And she said, you know, we only look at your last 2-year marks, so we'll look at your graduate records. And that's, what do you call it? But she said, get that autobiography, and we need it in by March. And I'm walking away, and she said, Peter, if God wants you to go to USC, there's not much myself or the Board of Trustees could do, is there? I said, pardon me? She said, Peter, I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for a few years. And I went back to the office, and I had a secretary. Her name was Gloria. She passed away a few years ago. And I loved that woman. She was just like my mom. And my mom was an alcoholic, and my mom had that great Irish Catholic faith that women have. And at the age of 62, she got on her knees and she said, "God, I'm an alcoholic and I can't stop and I need help." And she got up, never had another drink, never took another drink. Now, she was kind of paranoid for the next number of years. And she'd be looking out at the neighbors, and I didn't want to tell her they had moved 3 years ago, and kind of kept her busy. And but I love that woman, and, you know, if I could make my mom laugh, you know, it would break the tension in the house. And I was one of those guys, you know, who had a resentment against his dad, and I made my amends to my dad before he died. And at his funeral, a man came up to my brother and I. My brother was still alive at the time. And he said, "I'm George such and such." And I said, "How do you do?" And he said, "Don't you know my last name?" I said, "I'm sorry, I don't." He said, "When your dad was 5 years of age, he packed a suitcase and walked out of his family's home and walked 6 blocks up the hill and moved in with my grandparents, and they raised him. Didn't he ever tell you that? 5 years of old." The only thing I could put together was it must have been a raging alcoholic family that a five-year-old walked out of. And now I understood my dad a lot. You know, he was never a kid. He, just for survival, he had to get out of that family. And what do you call it? And I believe that was a spiritual experience that my God gave me so that I could understand where my dad came from. Because I don't even know whether my mother knew that story. We had never heard it talked about in the family. And where was I? I'm lost. Any of the guys behind you?
Gloria.
Where was I? Oh, Gloria. I called Gloria into the office one time, and I said, "Gloria, you probably," she said, "have I done anything wrong?" And I said, "No, Glo, but you probably noticed that I get some strange phone calls here at the bank." And she said, "No, I haven't noticed." And I said, "I do a lot of work in Alcoholics Anonymous, and guys I sponsor are free to call me here at the bank." And she started to cry, and I thought, did I say something? Did I hurt your feelings? And she said, "No, Peter, I was sober 3 months when you people hired me, and I never thought I'd work again. And you brought me in." And she said, "You've been so kind to me." And whenever I take the budget back to New York, the board would get copies of the budget that I would present for the next year. And at the bottom of mine would be typed, "Remember, God's in charge. They aren't." And I thought, oh my God, I hope that's not on their copy. But I said, "Glo, I have to write a 20-page autobiography. Would you type it up for me?" And she said, "Well, certainly." And I said, "You know what's going to happen? If I'm replaced, the new regional exec will probably bring his own secretary." And she said, "It's worth it." And the, what do you call it? And she typed that up for me. And I came back from lunch one day, and she had a pink telephone message, and it was, "Call this lady." And I called this lady. I called Glo, and I said, "Close the door," and I put her on speakerphone. And I said, "One way or the other, Glo, it's going to be God's will, you know, and I'm in a win-win situation." And this woman said, "Peter, we'd like to welcome you to the School of Social Work beginning in September." And and 3 years later, I'd be sitting in a room with 20 Crips and Bloods, Hispanic gangbangers, a couple of Aryan skinheads. And my first thought was, I'm going to die. I could have taken the 13-year-old if I hit him when he wasn't looking. And I would work with gangs in L.A. for 7 years. And, you know, my boss, one of the kids said, "Peter, were you ever in a gang?" I said, "I guess I'm in a gang right now." And he said, "What gang are you in?" I said, "I'm in the AA gang." And he said, "What blocks do they defend?" I said, "Hell, we're all over the world." And he said, "Do you have a gang sign?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "What is it?" "We surrender." So whenever this kid would see me, he'd go. And I'd go. My boss says, what the hell is that about? And I said, that's our gang sign. She said, I'm paying you to get them out of the gangs, and you're teaching them gang signs. And I would love those kids. And I take them to AA meetings, and I hope one day that I'll see one of them somewhere in a convention, because I tell them, right before you die, this is where you come. And these people will save your life and give you a life that's worth living and a thing. I always like to close my talks with something that happened to my wife and I. We've been married 46 years, and and that's because of the power of this program, who I choose to call God, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and these 12 steps. But I want to close with something that happened to us on our 22nd anniversary. We would always try and go away somewhere, and we decided to go up the coast to San Luis Obispo. And I had a sponsor, Deke, and one time I called Deke because she wasn't being a very good wife. She had forgotten the hot sauce with the chicken three times. I called Deke and I said, Deke, I want a better wife. And he laughed and said, be a better husband. He hung up on me. There wasn't a bunch of burst of applause from the guys on that one. So anyway, we're driving up the coast, and Lucius said, Peter, I heard a guy, this sales tape, and you would just love it. And I said, well, what is it? And he said, well, whenever he had a problem, he'd say, God, that's fantastic. And then he'd try to figure out what was fantastic about the problem. I said, I don't understand. He said, well, he was in Houston Airport or one of the airports, and he got up to get his boarding pass, and the woman said, sir, I'm sorry, there's a four-hour mechanical delay. And he said, God, that's fantastic. She said, sir, 200 people have just tried to rip my eyes out because they have a four-hour what's so fantastic? And he thought for a moment, and he said, isn't it fantastic you found the problem on the ground and not at 40,000 feet? And he said, you know, I'm a salesman. And he said, and there's probably 100 salesmen in this airport. And he said, I'm going to go around and give my card. And they'll remember that crazy guy who was giving his card out to salesmen. And maybe I'll get it. He said, this is getting more fantastic the more I think about it. And what do you call it? So I said to Lucia, well, let's try it. Whenever we have a problem, we'll see. That's fantastic. And you know, so I told you earlier, I have a mind like a sieve. I forgot all about it. And we're in the right lane going along, and this guy pulls across two lanes and pulls in front of us. I hit the brakes, and there's white smoke coming out of the tires, and he exits. You know, and I let him know his family was number one in mine thing. And my wife goes, God, that's fantastic! What the hell is fantastic about that? And she thought for a minute, and she said, well, if we would have gotten killed, we would have lost the hotel deposit. And we started to laugh, and I didn't have to pull off and find him. You know, wait out at his house for 2 days to get him. And we get up to this hotel in San Luis Obispo, and I go in, and if my wife is with, my last name is Smith, which makes, when I'm checking in with her, I go, is it okay if we use Smith, honey? That's why I'm sore on this side. And so anyway, I said, I'll go in and get the keys and everything. And I walk in and I said, reservations for Smith. And he said, oh, Mr. Smith. He said, we have a convention in town and we gave away your room. I apologize. That's fantastic. And he said, oh, sir, people have been screaming at me all afternoon. And he said, because you're on American Express, we have to guarantee. And we put you in another hotel down the street there. And so I go out to the car and I said, honey, they gave away our room. Isn't that fantastic? And she starts laughing and she said, well, where do we go? And I said, they put us in another hotel. Now the alcoholic gear kicks in. I'm in the Bates Motel, aren't I? This guy's going to come out to get our luggage, I know. So we pull up, and there's like construction going on and construction tape, and you know, the side of the hotel looks open and everything, and the restaurant looked open, and I go in and I said, they had given away our room, and he said, "Oh, Mr. Smith, we're glad you came down." And he said, "Look, we don't have any rooms, but we have a brand new suite in the new wing, and we're going to give you that." I said, "Fantastic." It had two bathrooms. We could have played tennis in this thing. What do you call it? So the bellhop, who looked like he was 12, takes us over to this thing. And I said, "Look, we want a good steak. You know, is there a good place to go?" And he said, "Oh, there's a great steakhouse. Go 2 blocks down, go 4 blocks up, go 6 blocks this way, go 3 blocks up." I'm about 2 blocks, 6 blocks up, 3 blocks up. He leaves, and my wife said, "You didn't hear a word he said, did you?" I said, "That's why I married you. You read directions." And so she gets us to the steakhouse, and I mean it is mobbed, you know, what do you call it? And we go in, and the guy said, "Do you have reservations?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, it was about a two-hour wait for a table." And I said, "Well, you know, that's fantastic, because we never get to talk, and we have 2 hours to sit over by the stream. She can have a glass of wine, and I'll have a Coke, and we'll get to talk, and this is fantastic. Put us down." And the guy said, "All right." About 40 minutes later, he comes over, and he said, "Mr. Smith, happy anniversary. We had a cancellation for a reservation. We want you guys to have it." We went, "Fantastic!" And away he went. And that's the way the whole weekend went. Every time we'd get lost, we'd be going down an alley in San Luis Obispo, and we'd be, "Look at the garbage of San Luis Obispo! How many tourists see the garbage of San Luis Obispo?" And so it's Sunday morning. And see, my sponsor, Deke, would make me get up every morning at 5 a.m. and make her coffee. This is one of my amends that I had to make to her, because she had to leave for work at 6 a.m., and I didn't have to leave until 8. And every night I'd say, "I made coffee yesterday. I want to sleep in." And a voice would say, "A loving person would get up and make her coffee." And I knew I'd see him at the morning meeting, and I'd be so guilty. I'd say, "I didn't make coffee!" So every morning I'd get up, and then one morning this voice said, "A loving person would go outside and get her the paper." I said, "I'm in my underwear. It's cold out there." But it sounded like Deke, and I'd get her the paper every morning, and she'd come over and sit on my lap and kiss me goodbye and say, "You're such a loving man." Sunday morning, we're at this hotel, and I don't have to make coffee. And I'm snuggled about 8 o'clock under the sheets, and she's in taking a shower. And a voice says, "A loving person would go up to the restaurant and get her coffee." Who the hell invited you? So I get up, I get my jeans on, I put a sweatshirt on, and I knock on the door, and I said, "Honey, I'm going to get up and get you the paper and coffee, and while I'm taking my shower, you can relax." And she said, "Oh, you're such a loving man." And I go up to this restaurant, and there, 180 miles up the coast, standing with his back to me, is Deke. There was an AA convention in town, and Deke was speaking at it. I walk up quietly behind him, and I tap him on the thing, and he turns around, and he goes, "Peter, what are you doing in San Luis Obispo?" And I said, "I needed a hug." And he gives me a big hug. And just then his wife, Joy, comes out, and she goes, "Peter, what are you doing in San Luis Obispo? This is fantastic!" So if you're new, and it ain't fantastic yet, keep coming back. You'll eventually get there. On behalf of my daughter Kirsten and my daughter Jenny and my wife Lucia, I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for bringing them back to me. And most of all, on behalf of my God, I want to thank you for bringing me back to my God. Thank you and good night. God bless.